Good morning. This is Clay Boykin, and I am in search of the new compassionate male. Yesterday, my producer, Dennis Tardon, and I had the opportunity to visit with Jeremy Solomons. Jeremy's located in Kigali, Rwanda, and he's an independent global leadership consultant, a fascinating person, a person that I met 4 years ago, and I'm just thrilled that we had the chance to talk yesterday. Here's that conversation.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and I'm the producer of a search for the new compassionate male with the founder, Clay Boykin.
Yeah. Hi, Dennis.
We have our guest today, an acquaintance of mine that I met many years ago, that Clay has known for 4 years ago, all the way from Rwanda, Jeremy Solomons. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello. Good morning. It's morning there. That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. An afternoon. So what is it that you're doing in Rwanda? Why Rwanda?
Long story. Do you want the 2-minute response, 2-hour or 2-day response? Very briefly, as it affects, if we're talking about compassionate males, because this is a fascinating country. Most people know about the 3 G's when it comes to Rwanda. They know about the genocide that happened here 26 years ago. Yeah. A million people were killed in 3 months. Mm-hmm. They know about the gorillas up in the mountains. It's one of 3 countries which still has mountain gorillas. And they know about gender. They don't know much about gender, but they do know that, for example, Rwanda has the most women in parliament of any country in the world. It's about 2/3. Which is triple what it is in the US. And that's kind of how I got here. I met somebody who was doing social media for a women's university here called Akile Institute for Women. And that sounded interesting. And they invited me over to do some coaching and training. And I fell in love with the institute. I fell in love with the country. I fell in love with the just whole environment. And came back here to visit again when I was looking to maybe try something new, and actually moved out here 15 months ago. Mm. So I'm still doing similar work around leadership, leadership development, global leadership, women's leadership, but in a very different context. So that's what kind of keeps me interested, engaged. And then the last 4 months have been certainly challenging in the sense of not being able to get out, working from home. But as you can see from the background, it's not too bad here. I've got the banana tree in the background, and we just culled our first huge bunch the other day, and they're just ripening. So we're awash with bananas right now. And so it's been interesting. Connectivity bandwidth is an issue here. So I've been doing a lot of one-on-one calls, phone calls, coaching. I've even coached people by text on WhatsApp because the phone wasn't working properly. So you just have to be very creative, still in touch with the world, still following what's going on in your part of the world with, I must admit, quite a bit of horror. I feel much safer here than I did, would have done in the US or in my original country, the UK. The government here is very used to dealing with health threats such as Ebola and AIDS and malaria, and they were well prepared. When I came back from my last foreign trip, the early February, they already had people at the airport checking people's temperatures, and we locked down. We were the first country in Africa to lock down, and as it stands right now, we've only had 5 deaths here in 6 months, and 3 of them were imported from other countries. So It's a good place to be, even if it's somewhat challenging work-wise.
How did it get to be 2/3 women, and what does it have to teach us? What are the lessons that we can look at Rwanda and say, teach us?
Well, it's interesting because you're talking about compassionate males. Our president is a very, very interesting person because on the one hand, he is a rebel leader. He was the one that liberated the country from the Hutus who were conducting the genocide. aided by the French. And so he's a military man. And, you know, he is sort of authoritarian in the sense of brooking no opposition. And yet he had the foresight with no political experience whatsoever to realize after the genocide, where a lot of people have been killed, men obviously, but also women and children, that there was a great underutilized resource in this country, which were the women. And so at a time when 26 years ago, many girls did not get a proper education, if at all, particularly out of the big cities, he said, you know, no, all girls need to get a proper education and be encouraged, and people throughout their careers be encouraged to advance. And so created a whole different environment in which women, well, girls and women could thrive, could be respected, could achieve positions of power. And it's just become kind of normal, similar to other countries, I would say, India, China, who have had women in prominent positions for a long time. US has not, as we well know. And so that is a really interesting case in terms of how do you change the dynamic? Well, unfortunately, very often it's the people in power, and those very often are the men. And here you have a former rebel leader that had the wisdom, sensitivity, and compassion to be able to say, we need to change the way that we're doing things here. And it has been phenomenally successful. And I do believe, firmly believe, that maybe the next president or the president after that will be a woman, which has happened elsewhere, obviously, in Africa. And so it's a great case study in how to take a country that was in ruins. The analogy would be Japan after the Second World War, Germany after the Second World War, the US after the Civil War, and rebuild it, well, through reconciliation, truth and reconciliation, similar to what they did in South Africa, to unify it, bring it together, and then be able to reconstruct the society. And it's only 26 years. It's fairly recent.
Wow.
And if you compare the progress of Rwanda compared to South Africa, that has done a lot as well. The apartheid obviously went on much longer there, was much more deeply ingrained, and is much more complex. Yet at the same time, if you look at the way society is in terms of equality, in terms of lingering racial issues, et cetera, et cetera, the race and ethnicity is not an issue here anymore. The number of times that I've heard even taxi drivers will say to me, well, my mother was a Tutsi, my father was a Hutu, I'm a Rwandan now. And so that, to me, is a credit, again, to the strong leadership of being able to recreate a sense of national unity. And that is something quite extraordinary to do that, which I think, you know, again, the US parallels are what happened after the Civil War, which unfortunately, you know, led into Reconstruction, led into obviously the Jim Crow laws, civil rights, you know, so eventually we got it right, but it took us another 100 years in the US. And so that really has to be looked at. And also the Holocaust, obviously what happened after that. Probably a better analogy is with the Holocaust rather than civil war in terms of how a country can turn itself around, reunify and create prosperity and peace, which Germany did, which Japan did as well, although there's issues there in terms of reparations to Koreans and Northern Chinese, etc. So it's an interesting case study in how you take something from total deconstruction and reconstruct it again.
So, Jeremy, if we're going to do this here, one of the things you talked about in South Africa was the reconciliation and being able to do that. It seems like that's what's happening right here in the United States, that the very edges of that are talking about. The minute we talk about, it's been a journey for me to go from what does the word reparation mean, and really to get it down to the word to repair, and to get it, because there was a lot of capitalistic that I have as a capitalist. Who knows where I'm going with this, with my own sense of what capitalism is and how it could be, as I would hope it could be. But still, it seems like we're just now coming to be able to talk about that here.
Yeah, and it's taken 400 years. And my fear, you know, I know we're not talking about the US, we're talking about Rwanda, but my fear, my great fear is as has happened after, you know, horrible mass shootings, that people get, you know, very concerned and very active for usually about 3 months. And then suddenly, because there's no systemic change, because Congress, particularly Senate, is not willing to take meaningful steps, that in the end, it will just go away again. That's my great fear in terms of that, and particularly with the current leadership. And so it does take strong leadership, sometimes even authoritarian leadership, to be able to come out of that. So obviously South Africa had the great benefit of having Nelson Mandela, who had the authority, the leadership, the backing, the global backing as well, to be able to rule through that absolutely vital 5-year transition period, during which the truth and reconciliation process was started and then was continued after he graciously stepped down, as he promised to do. This process here is a bit different. What they realized was, because there were tens of thousands of perpetrators, because unlike South Africa, unlike Nazi Germany, the atrocities were not just carried out by troops, by soldiers, by special forces, special units. This was neighbor on neighbor. This was even family member on family member. And so when you have that level of betrayal, violence up close, then something else needed to be done. And so what they did was they went back in a very traditional form of justice called the Gacaca Courts, G-A-C-A-C-A. And basically what it is, it's a form of community justice where within each community, if somebody wanted to be liberated or, you know, pardoned for their sins, they had to come in front of the whole community, village, whatever it was. They had to acknowledge and admit their sins. They had to be genuinely remorseful. They had to basically plead for forgiveness. And that was the first step towards rehabilitation, not just of the individual, but of everyone around them. Because, as I said, it affects whole families that were left. So, for example, I have a close friend here whose father and three brothers were all killed during the genocide. She's never even seen a photo of her father because the house and all photos were destroyed. And what astonishes me with her and with many people I met is this, you could say it's fatigue, you could say it's PTSD, but a certain level of graciousness, willingness to forgive. And if we're talking again about compassion, both male and female, this willingness to just almost accept it is the worst of humanity, and we survived it, and we now have to live together. So there actually are here, and Clay, I was, you know, going to take you to them, these reconciliation villages where you have villages where you have Hutus and Tutsis that literally were killing each other 26 years ago and now live together, work together, socialize together, even intermarry again. And so it's incredible what has been done. Now, the difference I would draw with maybe South Africa and the US is that the descent into chaos, destruction, mass violence was relatively recent. It really started about the end of the 50s, just before independence. So it was a kind of 35-year descent into hell and then a 26-year journey out, Whereas, as we said, you know, in the US it's 400 years. In South Africa it was, 100, 200 years. Likewise, India, 150 years. So the gestation period is much longer. So it takes that much longer to be able to come out of it. And as you said, Dennis, you know, reparations is not just about money. Some of it is just quite simply taking responsibility, being accountable for saying that even, you know, it's too easy to say, well, it wasn't me, or my family wasn't here, or I wasn't involved, or I wasn't enriched beyond it, or my, you know, I have no links to the plantations. It doesn't matter. As an empowered person within the society, everyone has a responsibility to be able to deal with the demons of the past, literally, understand what happened, and then be able to play their part in healing and bringing, repairing the society. And my personal fear right now is, as you're seeing on the streets of Portland, is that the US is facing a period of mass violence, not genocide, but mass violence. Whether it's the, you know, highly militarized police, or, you know, sort of militias, people with guns, rifles, all kinds of stuff. And I think it's a genuine concern around the election and this, whatever the result, basically, I do see mass violence. The Kigali Genocide Memorial here has adapted some work of a social psychologist, Irvin Staub, in the US, and there's a continuum of violence and a continuum of beneficence or peace.
Yes.
And there are 10 steps down and 10 steps back up. Rwanda's been through all 10 steps, which ended in genocide, has now come back towards peace. I looked at it for the first time a few weeks ago, and I reckon the US is on step 8 or 9 right now.
In the down, descent.
Down.
Down. And it's the next step is mass violence. So, you know, if we're talking about male compassion, you know, and again, I don't know if you're going to edit this out, we have the least compassionate male in the White House, and who is fueling this potential for violence.
Yeah.
So the situation is so critically dangerous. And unfortunately, a lot of people think, oh, well, what should you care? You're 10,000 miles away and it's none of your business. Well, it is my business, because mm-hmm. the US is the, you know, world leader in many areas. People do look to the US for guidance, for help, for support. My daughter, as you know, Clay, is there in Texas.
Yes.
So it's everybody's concern, just as gender issues are everyone's concerns. The potential for mass violence in the richest country in the world is hugely important. And I, right now, I don't feel that people are taking that threat seriously enough. And it's very, very concerning to me.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because, Clay, you come from a warrior experience. You were in the Marines. You have made this connection from being the warrior and taking and being part of that. To be, you can understand what Jeremy's talking about and what the mindset is that we're facing here, can't you?
Well, yes. The my experience in the Marine Corps was, I look back at it every day. It was some of the best time of my life. Fortunately, we were not in war. It was basically peacetime. But the one thing that I came out with was a dear, sincere appreciation for servant leadership, that we take care of our men, that the backbone of the Marine Corps is that non-commissioned officer. And I went in as a lieutenant. And to realize that, I mean, I didn't know anything. And my survival depended on that non-commissioned officer. So that was my orientation going into it. So I can appreciate, Jeremy, what you're saying about the president and him and how he's approached things more humane. that we really are in this together. And in my service in the Corps, my God, we are. We do depend on each other. It's down to the point of, you know, in some services they talk about my superior officer. In the Marine Corps, we talk about our people that are senior to us. Nobody's superior to one another. And it's semantics in one way, but there's something really deep about that. Yes, you're senior to me. You have more experience than I do. But you're not superior to me. You're just another human being like me. Mm. And that carries a long way in the whole culture that I was exposed to in the Corps.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jeremy, I'm interested because I agree with you. If we put into our country a lot of personal weapons. We put a lot of, and then we also have, when we have, because Clay, you've been in search of the new compassionate male. And when we look to our leadership and say, what does the word compassion mean? How do you exhibit, walk compassion? How does that look? What would that look? And when we see the absence of it, it's very clear what can happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there are some examples. Again, you know, following it very closely from afar, some of the governors have, I think, been very good role models. Washington, Ohio, Maryland, New York. There have been some very good examples of compassionate male governors, both, interestingly enough, both Democrat and Republican. So we can point to that, but obviously their power is limited, and they've not been able to do that much on a national level, just within their states, which relatively speaking are all fairly healthy on the road back to recovery now compared with some of the others. So I think it's always very important, you know, my work in leadership is, and I take your point, Clay, about superiority, of having people that you can look up to, mm-hmm. not that you're afraid of, mm-hmm. Not that, you know, particularly because they control you, because they can take revenge or whatever else, that people that you admire, that you respect, that are represent a piece of something that you are, but also something you would like to be. I don't know if you've seen the movie The Five Bloods, Spike Lee's. It was just on Netflix. And it's a very powerful movie. And for me, you know, there's so many different cross currents in it in terms of solidarity, team, brotherhood, but also this allegiance to their fallen leader and what he represented for them, in terms of liberation, courage, so many different things. And you know, Clay, you must have had that in abundance in the Marines. I've had that in other contexts. And that, to me, is so lacking right now. That's unfortunately what I've always found, and I'd be interested to hear both of your views on this, is that when there is a vacuum of leadership, that's when terrible things happen. That's how Hitler rose to power in the 30s in Germany. There was a vacuum of leadership after the First World War Germany was allowed basically to go to pot in terms of hyperinflation and social disruption and everything else. You know, you've had that in South Africa. You've had that now in Zimbabwe, for example. There's many different countries where you've had elements of that, and that's when the worst things happen. And to me, this confluence of social division, political factionalism, combined with the coronavirus, combined with police brutality, renewed BLM movement, and obviously mass unemployment, economic downturn. I mean, you could not have a worse cocktail of things that could conflagrate into something much worse.
You know,
and there's no leadership. There's no leadership. And it's not just bad leadership. There's no leadership. It's just unbelievable. And people go along with it. Yeah. You know, 30 million people still support it.
to me, it seems like if ever there was a time and an opportunity to point to something that would bring our country together, you know, so many people are, you know, what's in it for me, individual in nature. But this is a common thing that everybody's affected by. And if a leader could stand up and say, we're going to rise to this together.
Yeah.
Put down left or right. Put down your politics. This is about humanity. Let's all rise up above what's going on down here.
Exactly. Let's
fix this. That's
we do have one leader, Clay, and you know, Joe Biden, he's been acting as leader as president. Yeah. He's been making the kind of speech George Bush did, to his credit. Mm-hmm. He gave a wonderful speech a few months ago. And that's what Joe Biden's been doing. Yes. He's been giving the kind of unifying, calming, supportive, reassuring speeches that the president should be giving. But unfortunately, a lot of people are not listening because he's Joe Biden. You know. But,
well, let's say that if we're talking about, I'm really glued into what you're talking about, the steps, because if it's our steps up, let's say that we get through this with a minimal amount of violence, that there will be violence, but there is. What is 9 and 10 as we're going down before we begin to come back up? Because assuming that we can come back up to a more compassionate society, what do you see this as? It's,
I mean, I can tell you, I'll share with you afterwards, although you're not allowed to publish it, I'm afraid. But stage 8 of the step down is the manipulation of people through their unhealed psychological wounds. They are more inclined to take part in violence against groups they see as threatening. Mm-hmm. Number 9 is increasing violence is justified through increasing dehumanization and demonization. And then number 10, which I fear the U.S. is moving towards, is a failing state. An extreme of difficult life conditions and the presence of war make it more likely that these conditions lead to extreme violence, such as genocide.
And then what's a step up out of that when we get to 9 on the other side and 8 and 7 so that we can have a path, see the path?
Now, what's interesting is that, you know, the steps down are more societal and the steps back up are more personal.
Thank you. That's what I'm at. That's exactly what I was hoping you were going to say.
And so I'll just read them to you briefly, but, you know, think about where compassion comes in. So number 1 is indifference. That's the first stage out, having no interest, concern, or sympathy for others. Also fear, mistrust, anger, and resentment at this stage.
Not my problem.
And this can last for a while. This can last for years. And then slowly, number 2 is opening up, being open to other ideas, other stories, other explanations, other people. So that's the second stage, which, again, may take a couple of years or more to get to. Then acceptance, similar to the Kubler-Ross stages of grieving. Acceptance, respect. Others, empathy, this is where compassion comes in, number 5. Caring, service towards others, displaying kindness and concern for others, which I would say is probably the closest to compassion. That's stage 6. Then connection, person feels positive relationship with someone else. 8 is community. 9 is love, outward love towards others. And that actually says the word, a deep feeling of compassion, trust, caring, giving towards others. Number 10 is peace. Harmonious relations, free from disturbance, conflict, anxiety, attention. So we're way, way away from that right now.
Right, but at least it gives us, at least we see a map that there is an opportunity. I mean, you're in Rwanda right now. Clay and I are in Central Texas. And do you see social media and see the media and the opportunity to be able to get these ideas and spread them faster and get them in quicker in this that could possibly be an accelerant in this?
Well, what actually just today I submitted a formal proposal to the Genocide Memorial here that has developed a peace and values education curriculum, which is actually being incorporated into the national education curriculum. And they use these two models, which they've adapted, which is why I have to share them very carefully. And what I propose to them is to actually create a virtual train the peace practitioner program. So my idea is to launch as soon as September. It would be a four session, 3 hours each, to actually train people who are in any way focused on peace, on these kind of issues. So, you know, I'd love for the two of you and anyone else listening or watching this, if they're interested, to let me know, because I think that's the next stage, is that we need to get this word out now. Now is the time to do this. When I first started talking with them about it 4 years ago, there was sort of humming and hawing, and it was done very piecemeal, and preferably people coming here or in association with universities. Well, universities have their own issues right now around, obviously, distance learning, etc. But this is a time when we can use a virtual platform. And in fact, Corona's helped, because people are more used now to learning online. And so this is, social media is one thing, have articles, memes, whatever. But this is something practical that we can actually teach people to actually go out and use some of this, because Rwanda may be small, but we've been through all 10 steps down to hell, and we've been through all 10 steps back. So we have the credibility and the experience that pretty much no other country has. And so that's where we have the credibility, hopefully, but we also are able to, and this is my role as kind of the bridge, is to adapt what has been done in Rwanda, like the Gacaca courts, for example, the community justice, that is pretty much uniquely Rwandan, would never happen in the US. But there are elements, you know, that we can teach. And then, as I said, those 10 steps back up, those are things that anybody can learn, can practice around caring, compassion, interest in other people, openness to other ideas. And we, it's as if we've forgotten what that is. To me, that's the core of the U.S. If you talk about the American dream, what the U.S. is all about, Statue of Liberty, apple pie, we've lost it. And it's obviously not just in the last 4 years. This is, I would say, has been a process going on for the last probably 60 years. After the bloom of the post-war period faded, I think to me, that's when things started to go awry in the 60s. So it's been a long time coming. And that's where, you know, hopefully the three of us and many other people can help the US to get back, not back to where it was, but to a new reality, right, a new normal, whatever you want to call it.
Right. Well, I've got a question. Do we have to go that whole route? Can we truncate it? Can we turn it around? Do we have to go to the bottom before we can come back up the other side?
We don't have to, but my fear is, if you see what's happening every single day, what's happening in Portland in particular, Chicago, what the president is saying, what the president is not doing, I don't see any way out, because if Joe Biden took over tomorrow, then yes, I think we could avoid the worst of the mass violence. But we have another 4 months of this chaos, potentially 6 months until the handover. And you know that the results are going to be contested. Mm-hmm. You know that there are going to be protests, violent protests. So I wish I could say that it could be avoided. My fear is that it's going to be very difficult to avoid it in these circumstances.
Yeah.
Given all the other stuff around Corona and around mass unemployment and everything, and just the level of weaponization, it's unbelievable. And, you know, both of you were there in Texas. You know, chances are people have guns. Most people we know are peace loving and would never use them against another human being. However, likewise, Rwandans were very peace-loving, and nobody could ever, ever imagine the level of fratricide violence, brutal violence. And it wasn't guns. It was machetes here. And still to this day, when I'm here, I still cannot believe that this happened in this wonderful, peaceful country. But it did. And, you know, it was the worst of humanity. Likewise, you know, obviously in Nazi Germany, in Cambodia. I mean, there's so many examples where ordinary human beings, the banality of evil, Hannah Arendt, can come out in so many different ways. And again, talking about social media, just as the radio station, a couple of radio stations that fueled the hatred, calling the Tutsis cockroaches, for example. Likewise, you know, social media nowadays, what's going on, you know, sort of on Twitter, on Facebook. I mean, what they're doing now is way too late. That should have happened 5-10 years ago. And then you've got obviously all the extreme websites that haven't been shut down that people can easily access. So in a way, that's the modern propaganda machine that, you know, the Nazi propaganda machine would have been so proud of, you know, to be able to utilize that. It's happening in the US and elsewhere and being manipulated. And again, the difference between the US and, say, Russia, where Putin obviously is a master manipulator, but there isn't a level of gun ownership. People don't have the access to weapons of death. In the US, they do.
You know, the sheer ignorance that we run into over here. When I was due to go there to Rwanda to visit you in March, as soon as I began setting up that trip, I would say 9 out of 10 people that I shared that I was going there said, "Oh my gosh, you've got to be careful. Rwanda, don't go to Rwanda. We've got no clue. We got no clue what's going on."
None. And it's amazing because one of the things about you, Jeremy, is that there's such a pragmatism about you. I do not. I see a deep clarity. By no means a firebrand or try. I see a logical, clear thinking. Let's take a look at it as careful, almost as if you're a surgeon coming into an ER with and seeing. So the piece that you've developed within yourself to be able to look at this, even though you do fear it, you do feel like that the challenges that we have, how do you maintain your peace and maintain your center to know not just what's yours to do, but you've had to stand up against different corporations and different corporate boards and say, because you were in the, you're very much in the corporate realm around the world, and say, let's take a look at this a different way.
I think this is, you know, there's different terms. The one I like is self-leadership or personal leadership. That's where it starts, is that we have to know who we are as people, what our values are, what's important, what we won't compromise on, what we're aiming for. And you said pragmatism, but I think I would like to believe also I have a good level of idealism as well.
It's the pragmatic idealism. That's what I'm talking about. It is a pragmatism built. It is an idealism built upon pragmatism.
Yeah. And so that's a place to start, is have, you know, a clear clarity about yourself, about your values, what's important to you, what you want to achieve, what you feel you can achieve, how you want to influence others in to be able to achieve those goals. And then, you know, being aware of hot buttons, of blind spots, of, you know, what is there any ulterior motive, all those kind of things.
And I've been in me, so I see my own. What are my ulterior?
Being accountable to yourself.
Years in different ways. When I was there in Austin years ago, I was part of a men's group for 7 years. which was a wonderful way, very intimate, different way of being able to explore issues around not just who we are as men, but who we are as human beings. And it was a great voyage of discovery, and really helped me again to ground myself of who I was at that time, was as a husband, as a father, as somebody in society, trying to achieve change in a sustainable, nonviolent way. So it comes down different ways. The beauty of the corona lockdown is that I've had an awful lot of time working here in my home for the last 4 months. And I'm used to where I've been working from home 30 years. So for me, it's not been a big difference. But because I've not been getting on a plane 2 or 3 days a week, I've not even been going to lunches or meetings 2 or 3 days a week. I've had a lot of time to think. I've been doing a lot of writing, and that helps to clarify. I follow the news very closely. I send out updates to other people. Other people send me. Sometimes it's very disturbing articles about, for example, how diversity has impacted, or corona has impacted, people of color, different socioeconomic levels. So people send me a lot of interesting articles that make me think, and then I try and return to share some of these things, and also I try and share some funny stuff as well. So it's that sort of just sharing of ideas, of thoughts, in these days of, you know, fake news and what are facts, real facts, to just get these different perspectives. That in a way is the only way we can sort of try to have any attempt to see what's really going on and what might happen, is just listening to others. I can't bring myself to read some of the extreme websites and things, but I'm sort of aware of what's going on. And then news sources, for example. So yeah, I read the New York Times and Washington Post, and they are good. I do trust them, although they do make mistakes. I do watch the BBC News, and they have a different perspective. And my favorite news source actually is Al Jazeera in Qatar, that has a very different perspective. And so again, it's part of that triangulation or quadrilation or whatever it's called, to be able to see the world from different perspectives. And even the local newspaper here that I write for, there again, they have a very different perspective on the world. And the lack of respect that Rwanda gets, for example, from the rest of the world, because we're a small country, and as you said, Clay, nobody really knows what we are, and the only thing they know, again, maybe about the genocide, and still think it's going on. Or right now, that they assume that because of coronavirus that people must be dying on the streets. So all of that, whereas, you know, if you go around the country right now, or the city, everybody's wearing a mask, people are social distancing, people are washing their hands. It's, you know, sort of just natural. There's no debate about it. The government says that it is for your benefit to do that, and we do it. And you can say, oh, it's police state forcing people, you know, sort of to give it the liberty. No, it's helping people to survive. So again, it's just a different perspective. And there are, you know, cultural elements to it. This is a more collectivistic society, more hierarchical society. Yeah. So naturally, people are more concerned about each other, and they do respect authority. And again, as you said earlier, Clay, about, you know, seniority as opposed to superiority. Mm-hmm. So they respect seniority, whether it's, you know, your elders at home, whether it's senior people, leaders within organizations, government, corporations, whatever it might be. And US, I think, you know, it's simplistic to say it, but you've seen so many examples of it. This individualism,
right,
of saying, you know, I have the right to do what I want and basically screw anyone else. This sort of libertarian saying that, you know, you can't mask me, again, going out to the president, I think has, again, expose these fissures within the society in a literally a deadly way. Tens of thousands of people have died unnecessary deaths in the US, also in places like Brazil, because of the cultural, hardcore cultural beliefs mixed in with a lack of leadership or irresponsible leadership. Mm-hmm. So it's just a deadly combination, literally deadly combination.
Well, you said, Jeremy, expose fissures. If the fissure weren't there, if it were exposed, there wouldn't be a fissure. So this is, it's like there is a, what it feels to me and what Clay, you and I have talked about many times, is that this is getting us down to the original sin of what we were built upon. We are a country that was built upon the concept of white supremacy and removing the indigenous people in order to take it. So if it was built upon that, there was some time when that bill must come due.
Right. Yep. Unfortunately, it's taken 400 years. You know, we've had plenty of warnings along the way, and we've just not listened. And, you know, that's the astonishing thing, that the U.S. has risen to this superpower status in the world through some elements, yet has been creating an environment of utter decadence and degradation, which is now, you know, coming to fruition, which seems a very positive word to say, you know, just coming out into the open. And a lot of people still don't see it because, again, they're seeing it from such a polarized view that, you know, and the way the president does, again, always looking for someone else to blame instead of taking responsibility. And again, I think, you know, we talked a lot about politics. If we can come back to, you know, the new compassionate male and female too, but for men, you know, because unfortunately men through history have been more associated with violence, with division, with polarization, that, yeah, we've got certain people, I think, like Biden and certain of the governors who can show leadership from the top. Certain corporate leaders are showing that as well. People like Tim Cook at Apple, for example. I think Bill Gates, ex-Microsoft, you know, he's done a very good job, Warren Buffett. So there are some people who have shown, men who have shown leadership, but at the same, or and we all need in our own spheres of influence to be able to show leadership at this time. And that's something which a lot of people are not doing and just say, well, what can I do? I'm just trying to, you know, keep my family safe. I'm trying to make a living. And for those people, certainly, you know, you have to look at that first. Thinking about Maslow's hierarchy, you've got to look at those basic needs. But there are plenty of people who are in positions of privilege, of power, that can do more and can have an influence, at least in their community. And, you know, and I'm not talking about protests. That's important. I'm talking more about you know, working with people, you know, talking to neighbors. It may seem ridiculous, but just talking to neighbors, showing that you care, checking that an older neighbor has food, talking to someone down the street that if you see some sign or you hear something, you know, having the courage to have that difficult conversation with someone, particularly as a neighbor who you might see every day. And I'm thinking of that St. Louis couple that were brandishing the rifles. You know, that I just wonder, would any of their neighbors go and talk to them as human beings rather than demonizing them and calling them Karen or whatever? I hate that term, Karen, because it's another form of stereotyping.
You don't know our neighbors. We don't know our neighbors. You
exactly.
know, we were talking about that yesterday. You know, I was kind of saying it tongue in cheek, but it's true. As soon as we got air conditioning, everybody went inside.
Exactly.
You know, well, we don't know the last name of our neighbor, you know.
I remember I worked with a Colombian couple that had just arrived from Bogota. This is probably going back 10, 15 years ago. And they were living up near Far West. And, you know, there's nice houses there with rolling lawns. And they said, you know, we just don't get it. We will go out on our front porch at night. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hot, but we're used to that. And there is no one on their porches. There is no one on the street. Everyone just drives by and we don't understand. Can you please explain that to us? You know, why is there no human contact? Why does nobody talk to each other in the grocery, in HEB? You know, they're just at parks. Why do people not talk to each other? They're just in their own little space. At gyms, why did nobody talk to each other when they're working out? You know, they just didn't get it. And it was such an obvious thing that, you know, really struck me. We're, again, individualism to an extreme. And I also might suggest a certain fear, again, because of weaponization, of not knowing who your neighbor is, not knowing if they have guns. And this may be, you know, my thing around guns. And my daughter has at least three friends who were killed through guns. So it's very personal for me. And so how do we get that back? How do we get back to some feeling of neighborhood and community? And I don't have an answer, unfortunately. I think it can only be done one person at a time. As Mother Teresa said, do not wait for leaders, do it yourself one to one. I think that's all we can do right now. But clearly it's going to take time.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeremy, for your time today. Clay, what a gift it is that you brought Jeremy on and reconnected me, my old friend Jeremy. What a lovely, gracious man you are, and what you are doing to heal the world. And I shall emulate you, walk with you, and continue to connect with you. Clay?
Yes, and my hope, I've got a list of questions this long. So my hope is that you'll come back and that we'll have conversations that will continue. And no, we're not going to edit this.
No, this is all the way through the way it was. Thank you. It's the full Monty of Jeremy.
All right. Well, you know, I hope I don't get myself into trouble for some of my political comments, but at least
not at all. Not at all. They are your beautiful comments. Have a wonderful day, Jeremy. Thank you so much, Clay. Thank you so much, and we'll see you all next time.